Hi, you guys are listening to Barrel Talk Radio. This is Danielle Campbell. I'll be your host today, and I'm very excited to announce our two guests right now, which is the Cassie Mowry and her partner, fiancé, horse trainer, helper, everything. I think he qualifies as everything, Michael Boone. So, you guys, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Looking forward to it.
Oh, we're all looking forward to what Michael has to say today. He's going to provide some really cool insight. I think it's cool that he doesn't compete, but a lot of people do know, but it's shocking how many people actually don't know what some of the horses he's trained. I mean, Mulberry Canyon Moon, for one, and, I mean, he's had a big part in some of the ones Cassie's had success on. So because he doesn't compete, yet he does ride, and he comes and he watches, he studies, I think he just has a whole different perspective and outlook on the sport and what makes people successful or not, and it'll be cool to hear that, and, of course, to talk to Cassie and her point as well. So pretty cool. Okay, we'll keep. This is unscripted, you guys. So this is the first time Cassie's ever done this, and I shamed her into it. So one thing about her, you don't have to do much studying. So I'll just go ahead and act like I'm a professional, and I'll keep leading this thing. So Cassie will not brag on herself. So I'll say this year she surpassed Troy Krumrein in becoming so far, thus far in the world, the leading rider of all time barrel racing. So congratulations. She probably doesn't even know that. That's how humble she is. And this year alone, she's won, I think Equistat's missing her pink buckle and her Calgary earnings, but without that, she's at $740,000. And I think with that, we figured she's nearing at $900,000 still with this week at the BFA and the National Finals Rodeo coming up, which she qualified going to 26 rodeos, I might add. So I think pretty much the world knows Cassie's talents and her successes, and we're just going to try to figure out why she's better than the rest of us right now. So figure a few things out, some secrets of the trade, but mostly just to look into their program and how her and Mike work together and what they think of their program and where it's going. So so I'm not really sure where to start here.
But well, it's a huge team effort.
It's a huge team effort, and it is, and from the outside looking in, that is what's cool about you guys, is obviously you both had success before you became partners, and now that you are, it's really cool to watch, because from a friend standpoint, I've watched you when you struggle or have trouble, and I've been at your house when Michael's there helping, and you'll go lope through, and you immediately come back. You talk to him, and you go and you make an adjustment right then. It's like he sees something, you guys talk it through, and it's really cool to watch that and see that partnership between you two, and then obviously the results of it when you show up somewhere. But I want to start because I think Mike has a lot to say here, so I'm going to ask him the same question I asked him earlier today, because I loved his answer, and I asked him, why is Cassie better than the rest of us?
I think I'd start off by saying I think the advantage that I have is I've worked with other people. I've worked with Troy, I've worked with Kibo, right. I've worked with Jamie, so I know different approaches to stuff, and I think most of the people that have been successful kind of only know their approach. And I've kind of picked up little things along the way to incorporate into our program that worked for us. But I think the thing that makes Cassie successful, in my opinion, is the attention to detail. I think anybody that's a good athlete or is elite at something, they always find out little things for an advantage, like a bit or approach to a barrel, a different type of bonnet or tie down. It's just all in the little details. I think that's the thing that separates somebody like Tom Brady from a regular NFL quarterback. I don't think it's necessarily just the talent. I think it's the desire to be better and to take chances, to always push yourself. Like, we've done really well, but we always try and do that much better. And I think for me, the biggest thing that motivates me is I don't ever want to disappoint her. So anything that I get of hers,
I think that's mutual.
I'm willing to kill myself for it.
Right.
And I think she doesn't want to disappoint me either. And I think we're totally different people. Like, she's real, like, laid back, both inside and out. And I'm only laid back on the outside. On the inside, I'm competitive. When we go to one of these things, I have a goal in mind, and I'm able to kind of steer towards that, where she's content to just make the good run. So I think we complement each other well.
And, right.
You know, I'm not somebody that really loves horses. I just love competition. And I like being part of something that can really do well and somebody that I see put the effort in.
Right.
But it's not necessarily just that she outworks everybody or is that much more talented. It's just all the little intangibles that separate.
So from the competitors, us, the people that are chasing her all the time, I mean, we actually do think she's that much better. At least I do. And we see a lot of things, and I study, and I watch her, and I try to figure it out. And at one point, I mean, my own boyfriend was like, what does Cassie do that you don't? Why is she better?
Right.
And the list could go on when you think of it. And I'm like, well, you know, we all work hard. Let's be honest. We all work hard to be here. But I do think she has timing and feel. But the little things you're talking about, I mean, I've heard her do it too. And I mean, I'm a bit queen also. I'm going to switch bids. But I mean, I've seen her, what you said, switching it to a different kind of bonnet, or it might be one whole adjustment, or her rein length and how it might change. And I think there's details like that that a lot of people don't understand can change everything about how you ride, how your horse responds. I mean, you may not think shortening your reins 2 inches is going to make a difference, but it might change the entire game. And that is something that you guys are extremely aware of.
It really helps having another set of eyes. Mm-hmm. When I see one of her horses ride, I can see things that maybe she can't feel. And what helps me the most on the horses that I ride for her is the first time I see her.
Right.
You can just see things from the ground that you can't feel from the back. And the fact that we both have enough experience and we know what each other like,
right,
it seems to work pretty well for us that way. Mm-hmm. But I think the main thing is just always trying to get better and to be better. Like, we've done well this year, but, you know, we want to keep doing better. And it's really a challenge. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of effort.
Right.
And I think now everybody has good bred horses, and the separation is just that much smaller. So mm-hmm. you've got to keep getting better, or somebody is going to pass you up.
Right. Yeah, the breeding industry has taken off, and, I mean, everything here is high quality now. Yeah. So it makes everybody have to up their game and do better. But you said something about watching her, and I want to ask, because this is a conversation amongst friends here that other people are going to be listening to, this is out of my own curiosity. When you watch her and you watch a horse and you see adjustments that need to be made, I want to know, do you watch the horse and its footwork and what it's doing? And then if you see something you don't like, do you see what Cassie's doing, or do you watch Cassie and what she's doing?
Are you talking just on Cassie or on other horses?
Well, let's not talk about any of the rest of us yet. When you're helping Cassie at home, like, let's say she's going slow.
It's normally the horse, because mm-hmm. I know she's doing her part. Like, she doesn't move her hands very much,
right.
So most people can't see it.
Yeah.
But when there's a problem, it's the horse.
Right.
I told Cassie one of the things that I think would be the most interesting for this conversation is when I get nervous, the most nervous in barrel racing isn't a slot race or a finals. It's the first time I take my 2-year-olds for Cassie to ride
mm-hmm.
because the standards are high. I mean, her standards are high.
Right.
And I know if something goes wrong, it's not the rider. It's the whole.
So you're going to, you take it very personal.
And given that
you're I'm going to get fired, dumped, everything in one day.
No.
I'm pinching him right now.
Scoot over here. You're sitting way too close to him, and you're not talking near enough.
No, it's not that. I just don't want to disappoint her. And the thing is when you're the only person that's ridden that horse and you've done all the slow work, it falls on you. And like, I'm pretty soft with my horses.
Right.
Because for the most part, when I get them, you know, they're broke and they know the basics, but everything else that they've done, I've either taught them to do or let them do, so it's on me. And that's, I like that aspect of it, but it's also pressure too. So I think
right.
a lot of not wanting to disappoint each other really kind of fuels both of us.
Yeah.
And I'll add, we don't have anybody else that rides our horses.
Nobody.
In between either of us getting on them. So if there's something going wrong, we can pinpoint kind of
what
where it
is,
started.
Right. Yeah, once they come from the colt starter, it's just mm-hmm. you two. And I will say that about Cassie. And it's something that, you know, you see a lot of different things in the industry. But I tend to agree with her in a lot of ways. Once she gets a horse, she doesn't have help. Like, nobody warms her horses up. I've never seen someone else on one of her horses. Like, she doesn't, when people do work for her, help her out, like, they're not out there riding and exercising her horses for the most part. And even when it comes to the ones that have come from Michael, I mean, they have a little bit of a thing where once Cassie steps on him for the first time, it's very rare that he's like, this is your horse now. Like, it's, and I think that's very important in what we do, because they have to rely on our cues and respond instantly. So everything we do in the warm-up and the training process is our cues, and they need to get used to that coming from the one person that's going to deliver them in a competition setting, where if you have someone else warming your horse up, no matter how much they try to ride like you, they can't. So I think it's a really cool thing about their program together and Cassie's program that is a, yet another thing that sets her up for success. I mean, that horse always knows what to expect from its rider and vice versa. And I just think that builds the confidence and helps to create champions and confidence when you go in the arena. So kind of a cool thing about them. But, Michael, obviously you guys have had a lot of great horses together and separate, but one and what everyone's paying attention to now this year has been obviously Emmett, famous ladies man. Just walk us through like a horse that you own that you'd start and then it goes to Cassie. How long do you have that horse in your hands before it goes to Cassie?
Most of the time from like April of its 2-year-old year to October and November of its 2-year-old year. Mm-hmm. And then you're right after that. I don't get on them at all.
Right.
I think it's important, like you do, for the same person to be on that horse. I'll get on one if it needs backed off or if she wants to see what it looks like with somebody else on. But like if she rides one of my horses for the first time, the next time I get on it, I can tell that it feels a little bit different.
Right.
But that's a horse that, you know, we picked out together. It's a horse that Cassie always liked better than I did.
Yes,
he's never been
a favorite. That.
He's never been a favorite of mine, and he still isn't. But he was a little tricky to train.
Poor Emmett.
So
he was a little tricky to train, and I knew that I needed to keep him forward around the barrels, which is what I'm good with.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that horse was a good horse as a futurity horse. But I think the difference is, like with that horse, I've had other horses that have won the same amount of money. But I think the key to that horse was if she never gave up on me. He always had a little bit of a hitch on the first barrel.
Right.
And it seemed like he always kind of let me down when it mattered the most. And I always kind of held it against him.
Mm-hmm.
And she was at Cheyenne or something like that. And he made a good run in the finals and stepped off the first barrel. And I'm like, man, this horse just doesn't get it. But she was patient with him the whole time and figured out he had a small issue with his back that took him from being a really good horse
to
being an elite horse.
Yeah.
And I think that's goes back to what I said. It's all in the details. It doesn't matter whether it's barrel racing or business or sports.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason why certain people have a little more success, and you try and mirror that. And that's something I'm talking. That's something that with a female rider you can do is have those horses longer term, and we don't really try and shortcut anything.
Right.
Like that horse has some minor stuff, and we'll let him off. But she's always believed in that horse more than what I did and really took the time to make him what he is. And that's something that I'm really proud of her for, because it wouldn't have worked out that way without taking
her,
all those extra steps and all the different vet work we've had done on people. Just that one thing was the key to taking him to the next level where he'd be, I would consider, one of the elite type horses.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been amazing to watch them this year and what they've done. And not a surprise to those, you know, that see it. A lot of people seem surprised when, like, a futurity horse jumps out on the rodeo scene and does what he did. But I think it was pretty obvious that he had what it took to stand up on that kind of ground and in those big arenas to go in and do his job. So it's really cool to see him come up through the ranks and then go and accomplish what he did. And certainly not the first one that she's been able to do that on. I mean, her whole life has been that. And obviously, Firewater Make Me Happy was the same thing.
Right.
I mean, a horse that she really stuck with. And he was great from the get-go, but just kept going and went to the NFR on him in kind of the same fashion. I mean, just very few rodeos. I think she came down to the wire to make sure she had her limit to get to qualify for the national finals and that. But
I'm not a rodeo type person. I've never followed it much, and you know, I have a lot of respect for what those people do, but it's not why I like to just drive somewhere and only have one chance. But of all the luck that I've had and good fortune I've had in barrel racing, I consider that horse win in Calgary the biggest accomplishment, and it meant the most to me.
This is the second time I got goosebumps and choked up today. Little things like that, like
right.
you say that you don't do this because you love horses, but when you say something like that, like it's a huge testament to what that horse is and what that win meant, because you have experienced a lot.
I think what it means to me is being a guy in the futurity world, it's an opportunity for these futurity riders and futurity horses to prove that they're the same caliber
right.
as the NFR type riders.
Right.
And what meant the most to me is I don't do like social media. I've never made a Facebook post or done anything. My Facebook account's one Cassie set up and managed, so I don't.
So you
post.
Could. We know why.
So I don't post stuff, and I got more messages and more emails and more friend requests from that one run at Calgary than I have in the 20-some years I've been at barrel racing. So I'm proud of the fact that that horse brought attention to futurity riders, especially my guy friends in the futurity industry. That, to me, that's a big deal to me.
Yeah.
It means a lot to me.
What's I asked this question to someone earlier today, but in different circumstances than yours, what's the greatest horse you've ever ridden?
I can't really measure them that way. I think the horses have evolved so much through the years. I think when I first started out, you had to just train a racehorse to turn.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have to train a horse that's bred to turn to wait until you want it to turn. So it's completely different than it was back then. And these incentive races have changed things so much.
Right.
It would be hard for me to say. There's some that I've liked better than others, from a personality standpoint. And surprisingly, my better horses weren't the ones that I liked the most.
Mm-hmm.
Probably my favorite horse would be the CP He Will Be Epic horse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just liked him. I liked his personality. I liked the fact that he was sensitive and smart. And Emmett's kind of he's just a pain, and he'll bite you and take advantage of you and stuff like that. So
Right. Based
on personality, he would be kind of middle of the road. And that year when we had those horses, I consider him best case at Placer. I would have sold that horse in the right opportunity. And the same with the Forced a Goodbye horse. I never thought those horses were the caliber they turned out to be. I just think you really have to pay attention. And the biggest thing I learned from Cassie is you have to pay attention to the horse's personality.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Forced a Goodbye horse, he just wants to do what you want him to do. He doesn't try and outsmart you. He'll just go where he's supposed to go. He's not like an elite athlete.
Yeah.
So I think you really have to pay attention to your horse, and it's something that she's good at, to figure out how to get him to do what you want. But we had four horses that year that I rode for Cassie, and I considered him number three,
right,
of the four. And she believed in him from the very first ride.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's something that's a gift. She knows how to judge stuff. And,
right,
you know, I know my role, and I know my process, and I know, like, how to get him to where she wants him to go to, but she knows better than I do when a horse has that little bit extra.
One thing that I've seen with Cassie, and people ask me, I guess because they realize that her and I are friends, and they're not nervy enough to ask her, so they come to me. I know, she's very intimidating. But one thing that I say about her, and this is just my outlook looking in, and I feel like she will do more to make a certain horse fit the program. Like she will, what we've been talking about thus far in this podcast, she will go above and beyond. But she'll also be one of the quickest people I've ever seen to cut a horse out of her program that is great on paper and looks better than most in the arena. And I've never actually talked to her about this, but I sit back and I watch it every single year. And even the ones that go, I mean, there's one that qualified for the NFR this year that was cut from her program right before the first futurity of the year.
Right.
It's not because she didn't realize there was talent there, but obviously there was something there that wasn't what she wanted to stick with. So I'm going to have to hear it from both of you, not just Michael. I want to know what makes you say, this is it, this is my last ride on this horse? Because we've all had the ones that are just terrible, that we're like, no mas, I'm done. But, like, you have done it with some good horses. I mean, you had a full sibling to Arson this year. And I remember when you went through that of, like, what do? Do I keep? Do I sell? And next thing I know, he's for sale, and he's gone. I haven't seen him since. So what's that deciding factor with you when you know that's a good horse, but you're fighting your head and you're like, no.
I think one of the biggest things I've picked up with Mike is styles and how important they are to suit the rider and the horse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I realized kind of what suits me now after training so many. And there are certain things that are just key for me. They have to feel or do something a certain way for it to feel comfortable to me. Whether it's right or wrong, it has to feel comfortable to me. And some things, you know, someone else might not like. If I have mine a little too bendy or a little too straight or whatever, it's more comfortable for someone else, and it just works better in either program. And I hate beating my head against the wall or feeling right. Like I'm not really getting anywhere. And that was, like, that one particular horse, like, he's talented, but it just, he didn't suit me style-wise. And so I went with the ones that maybe a couple of them weren't as athletic, but they just had that either personality that worked best for me. Like Will, the one he's talking about, is really sweet and really
right.
That kind of horse I work well with. And so I chose like one of them over a horse like that, just mostly the style and the feel. They need to have a certain feel for me. I don't have a whole lot of like upper body strength. I can't really get along with one that's real strong.
Right.
And so that's a big deal for me, is they do need to be soft and maybe a little apprehensive. I can get farther with that than one that's a little stronger or stronger willed. And I do, I try everything that I know on one, everything. And I ask, like, so many people at these futurities have so much insight, and like I've called you and we've discussed things, and I'll try my best to make one work out or suit me. But once I feel like I've exhausted all efforts that I can or know or change my style as far as I can, I will let it go, and I never regret it. And right. I love to see them go on and do well with
Absolutely.
Other people.
Yeah.
Like, that's the best part of it.
Well, because you still put the work in.
Yeah, it looks more comfortable, and it's a better style or suits somebody else better. And so that's just the way it was supposed to be. And I never look back on that. I'm thrilled for them, and gave me more time to put on something else, because I was putting a lot of time and energy into that, trying to figure it out. And once I feel like I've tried everything, I never look back.
Right. We're going to get rid of a few rumors right now. What's the max amount? And I know it can change from year to year, but when you start the year of three-year-olds, January 1st, what's the max amount you have or you want to have in your barn?
What do I normally have, about 10, 12?
I would say the maximum. You normally own about 4, 5, 6 and have about 10 total.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I normally take 3 or 4 and the ones that we own and try and get a start on those so we know better about what we have. I don't take anybody else's horses to my house in Pennsylvania, because we feel like if somebody's paying Cassie to train a horse, they want Cassie to ride a horse. So
we're just going to keep you hidden.
Okay. Well, no, even so. I mean, I don't want somebody to think that I'm out, you know, taking their horses off the place. I take what we like to Pennsylvania and get them started and see what we have. But, you know, I translate the style thing to boxing, which is where my background is certain styles work against other styles, and Cassie's really adjusted and really learned to ride a lot of different styles of horses, but there's some that neither one of us feel comfortable with, and it's the same type of horses. We want a horse to stay on its butt and stay moving in the turn, and some breeds are better for that, and I'm not much of a risk taker, so if I get a horse that doesn't want to do it the correct way, I'm not going to take a chance and screw it up, especially if it's one of her horses. I just wouldn't do it. And I wouldn't do it with one of mine either. So if the horse has to turn a certain way, or if it has to be too stiff, or it has to be something too dramatic, that's not for me. I'm not a chance. I don't like taking chances on anything like that.
Right.
I'll just say, hey, this isn't going to work.
I have people have asked before, when you guys have had something for sale, they're like, well, what do you think? And I was like, well, it's probably not, it probably wouldn't be for sale at this stage if it's something that they thought was really going to work for them. But there's also a big history of horses leaving her program that are quite successful. So, I mean, just going along those lines and I think that's, I'm glad that you both said it the way you did, because I do think that's something in the industry that we all fight with, because we don't want to disappoint customers. We don't want to disappoint ourselves, even when it's our own that we have to sell and get rid of because of what she's saying. But it does take away time from the other horses. And I think there's a lot of trainers out there that beat their head against the wall. And there's one thing I've said is, I don't know that I've ever, in pretty much as long as I've known Cassie, which is a really long time, but I don't know that I've ever seen her pull up to a futurity with a horse in the trailer that couldn't win first. And it dang sure is a placer. And if it was a placer, it's still left right away. Like, but by mid-year, everything in there, it's a first-place horse.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, we've tried to sell horses in sales and otherwise that worked out. I think she had that scooter horse for sale for not much money. It won the juvenile a couple of weeks later.
We have a few of these.
The Touch of Heaven horses won a lot of money this year. He was in a sale.
Mm-hmm.
The horse that we ran and made the first run yesterday in Futurity was for sale. I would have sold either of those two horses that we talked about earlier.
Right.
I think if you're going to own them and ride them yourself and you're not getting paid for them, you have to enter them. You have to know they're an elite type of horse for it to make sense. And I think some of those horses make perfect sense for somebody that's a smaller operator that has a lot of time to devote to one horse, that's content with a horse that just can place and pull checks and be a longer term type horse and maybe not a sure shot elite type whores.
Right. We're going to bounce around a little bit here just because, again, there are no notes and there is no script. But you guys, you get to go as a team to the national finals this year. So 10 runs in Vegas. And I know that some things didn't exactly work out going into the finals like everyone originally hoped. But you have some amazing horses to take and run. And I want to know, both of you, like, what are your thoughts? Because this is the first year that Cassie gets to go. I hope I say this the right way and it doesn't offend anyone, but this is the first year you get to go and you truly have the option to run horses that are owned by you guys. You get to run your own stuff if you choose all 10 rounds, and that's never really been an option before. So what is the difference going into the finals with that, knowing that this is your guys' team that you created to get there? What do you expect? Like, what are you looking for? Who's going to be running down the alley in the first round?
Well, so far, I feel a lot less pressure, and owning them and having them like this, and they've already accomplished so much, I just feel like if it's the NFR is one of those things, it's either you're weak or it's really not, and it hasn't been the best experience for me yet.
Right.
And so going with horses like this, I just feel like I can't lose. Like, they've already done so much. It'll be their week or it won't, and I'm just happy to be a part of it and happy to let them step out and get this attention that, you know, they wouldn't have. And yeah, it started out, the horse that got me there got hurt, and so he's going to be missing out and trying to reach down and see what else I can get ready for it. And Will's currently at the vet with bubble wrap while I'm here.
I'm like, oh gosh, what happened now?
Nothing. He's getting his fix.
He lives in bubble wrap.
Yes.
And which Will just, I mean, he ran a 13-0, set the arena record at the Stockyards on the new pattern, so it seems like he's ready. How many of your four-year-olds from this year are going to be making the trip to Vegas with you?
I think we'll bring Jarvis. As far as maturity, he's, like, the most
so
solid and, yeah, mature. He seems like something that could handle that and not think anything. I don't think it would be a setback for him.
Right.
And I think that he could handle a little pen like that, so he may run through the gate. I don't know. We don't really have a plan. It'll just, hopefully we can start out with Will.
It's Vegas. By the seat of your pants.
Yeah, that's just how it's going to be. And I'll just be, it'll either, you know, go great or it'll be a learning experience and hope I can help season mine and just get them better.
Yeah.
There.
Well, one thing I know is if anybody can confidently get a four-year-old through the pattern at the Thomas and Mack, I mean, it's the trust, just again, everything we've been talking about, the trust you develop and the confidence that you and your horses have in each other. When you're in those situations, they rise up and they listen to you. I mean, they look to you for guidance and instruction. I think that's important. And it's part of your way of training, is that they have to wait on you and listen to you. So it's a fine line between thinking on their own out there, but also being willing to be open-minded enough to allow you to direct
them.
Because there's a lot of great horses that really don't. I mean, good horses that we mm-hmm. see win, that they get in trouble and they don't want the help. But yours always allow you to place them and put them somewhere. And I think that goes back to, A, you have great feel and timing, but also you're the one on their back. So they understand those cues when you deliver them.
They don't always. But well, Jarvis does
bye.
Come back to me. Yeah. He is good about that. If he gets in a bind,
they do
he
have
does,
their own minds.
He does let me handle him.
Yeah. Michael, Las Vegas, 10 rounds. What do you see playing out?
I normally have a specific plan, and we normally set like some type of goal when we come to futurity, and this is really the first time I haven't done that. We're mm-hmm. just going there and hope to have a good time, leave with better horses than what we went with. It's tough. I mean, 10 days is a long time. It's a lot of runs.
Right.
It's 24 hours between runs, 24 hours between a bad run until your next run. We probably know we're going to have to feel our way through the first couple rounds. And, you know, those girls, they bring it for real. And half a dozen of those girls have been there a lot. And they have the advantage that they know when they send that horse down the alleyway what their horse is going to do. And we really don't yet. It's not really the pattern of the setup that's a concern. It's the environment. It's standing nose to tail in that chute and having that stagecoach run by. And so you don't know. I agree with both of you. You see good horses go to the NFR and just really struggle. And you see some other ones that adjust to it. So we're just going with an open mind and hoping to make the best of it. disappointed not to have the famous ladies' man horse there. But,
absolutely. Well, he's the one that got you there, and he's been in that situation of running in a crowd and I mean, running in those performances and different environments throughout the year. Will has really not been to very many rodeos, but, again, he's he has so much try. Like, I get choked up talking about him, too, just because he's – I know how special he is to you, but also just knowing horses in general and that he does, like that horse has such a huge heart and wants to please and get along. So
it's the first time he's been in a situation like this. Like Emmett's been the one where like the high pressure situations like Houston and Calgary and those down to the wire scenarios, he thrives on it. And the louder and crazier it is, he just always rises. Will's never had to go through that. I've put, you know, all the, Emmett went to all of the rodeos. He won all of my rodeo money this year. So Will didn't have to go, and I just take Will when I want to go to a big jackpot or Ruby Buckle or anything like that, and that seems to suit Will, and he's so apprehensive. So I'm hoping that he finds the courage to really, you know, go out there and run, and with all that going on, he's just not had to – he hasn't been exposed like that.
Well, I think just going off of what I was sent – and I could have missed something, but your first run at the Stockyards, you ran a 13.6, and then maybe you went to Athens on the NFR pattern, and he ran really well, and then you came back to Stockyards, and he ran a 13.0. Mm-hmm. So he had just a few runs on a tiny pattern and just kept improving. I mean, one run to the next, 6/10 faster at the Stockyards, so I think he's wanting to show, like, I can figure this out and step up and do it. So he just needs to in front of all those people.
Well, now we realize that big thing can get through that little pattern. Because that was a
question. How tall is he?
He's over 17 hands.
Okay, I just want everyone
else
to
know. So now we know he fits in there.
He can actually make it in between two barrels. But how much does he weigh?
I don't know.
Have you weighed him?
I thought it was 1,200 pounds.
It was, yeah, it was more because I asked my vet about the tube of warmer, and he's like, you need two tubes.
Yeah, probably.
It's over
so.
The 1250.
Will is enormous.
He's huge.
So.
But they were low-key, not, you know, not a whole lot going on, real quiet. So it'll be the excitement in the air about it. I hope he doesn't get scared.
Yeah.
He is timid. For a big horse, he's really timid.
Yeah.
And if something bounces into him in the alleyway, you know, like, I just don't know if he'll shell up. We'll find out.
Right. I mean, there's a few people that every year they go in there not knowing what's going to happen. So
I actually like him better in a small pattern. I think the best run he's made was Kinder of his futurity year, that small pattern where I think he won to go around by 3 or 4 tenths. And I thought it was probably the fastest run he's ever made and one of the fastest runs I've ever seen. And the run that he made at Stockyards, I mean, it was impressive.
Yeah.
I think it'll come down to the environment for him. Mm-hmm. And like Cassie said, whether he's willing to man up and be aggressive and say I'm taking charge of this, or if he wants to be passive and tentative. So we're going to find out.
Oh, I think the lead up for him getting there is kind of gearing him towards that, and at least the pattern of understanding to be aggressive in that small pattern. Again, I forgot about Kinder, but I mean, we just don't really run on anything that small anywhere but Kinder throughout their futurity year. So kind of hard to know what they're going to do, but certainly it'll be exciting to watch and fun to watch. And again, not ideal with what happened to Emmett, but certainly have a good group to still go on with. But I don't know. Getting back, Michael, go into these futurities. Again, I know we're bouncing all over the place because I don't keep notes. But tell me what else you've seen. Like, obviously breeding, and there's more money in the sport, so it's attracting more and more people. It's making all the trainers, riders, everyone up their skills to try to be better and better. Right. But what are some of the biggest changes you've seen in the futurity industry as you've gone?
I think it's the incentive money. It's just a crazy amount of money. When you look at the horses we have this year versus the horses we had in 2019, probably the same caliber horses, something like that. We had more of them in 2019, but made almost double the money.
Right.
And I think that's really encouraging for the industry, as somebody that's not like an outsider, but somebody that doesn't like do it for a living.
Right.
To see a lot of people making a lot of money. And I think a lot of these event producers are starting to figure out you can't just have it top loaded.
Right.
You have to pay down the line a little bit more. It can't be 100,000 and then down to 25 or 75. You got to pay more down. The Breeders' Challenge has done that, and mm-hmm. Royal Crown's done that, and these buckle races all pay so well
right.
that I think it's cool to see that you can make that kind of money nowadays, I think it brings more interest to the sport. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's a game changer. I never thought you could make that kind of money barrel racing.
Right. No, it's pretty impressive. Again, I mean, Cassie's getting right up there towards $1 million in 1 year, and that's without winning the American. You know, it's right. Something like that where you can win $1 million. I mean, she's had to do it on multiple horses
I think she's
throughout
already,
the year.
I think with the rodeo stuff, she's already passed $1 million.
Okay. See, and I should have asked you before because I know that you know. I'm going off Equistats and then, like, okay, the Pink Buckle in Calgary's not in there, so what all is going on? But, so, yeah, definitely not surprising.
Well,
but.
And I think it's – I'm not saying that to point out that she's done really well. I'm pointing out that
– well, it's a fact.
Like anybody, that anybody – that the money's there
right.
for somebody that has
yeah,
success.
Absolutely.
And what I tell some people that have been around a while is, like, one horse can change – not your year, but can change your life
absolutely.
Between what you can win on a horse and what a horse is worth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can buy a $10,000, $15,000 horse – and make $500,000 at it.
And people seem shocked by that, but we've seen it happen a few times this year where some of these futurity horses from last year and that are selling for over $500,000
yeah,
dollars.
For sure.
And I mean, and even geldings yeah. are selling for a lot of money that people can go rodeo. So it's not just the breeding aspect, it's people want to go win.
Right.
And I mean, if it's a mare, that's all the better for most people because of like the, what the embryos and whatnot brings when you go to the sales.
Right.
But
And also the derbies, like getting to run them longer and for this kind of money, I yeah. feel like has been a game changer.
So are you both advocates and for 8-year-old derbies?
I mean, just because then if I like them, I get to run them another
yeah.
year. But I mean, I think it's nice to have somewhere else to take them where there's good money and it's not rodeo.
I'll just point yeah. blank say that I wouldn't have the famous ladies' man horse without those extended derby years, nor would I keep the Forster Goodbye horse without it. I think it makes that much of a difference. It used to be if you could win $30,000, $35,000 on a derby horse, you were the top rider.
Right.
And that's not the case anymore.
Right.
You know, I think Emmett this year has won, $100,000 or more just in the incentive type races and is not even eligible for all of them. So I think not only is it more money for you professional riders, it's more money for the owner. It makes those horses worth that much more money.
Well, we don't have as many, like, just good old sweepstakes anymore.
Right.
Like, it's very, now that the D concept is in, so it makes it a little harder to go win that kind of money. And like
sure.
you said, if they're not in Pink Buckle, there really isn't an open race. So I've gone, the 8-year-old derby thing, I've always had two different views. That one of, you know, being a rider on a horse potentially that age, but also, like, 8-year-old isn't derby anymore. I mean, running for the money's great, but at what point are they no longer a derby horse?
Right.
But definitely see both sides to it.
And I think the other key factor is I think it makes these horses better because the professional trainers keep them longer.
Mm-hmm.
They're more solid. You're not going from a 4-year-old to running at a rodeo.
Right.
Those horses are seasoned a couple more years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Emmett's a way better horse now than he would have been had I sold him as a 5-year-old.
And that's an excellent point, too, because even selling horses, where a lot of futurity owners would be really quick to sell as soon as their 4-year-old's over, like, and that horse is going to go on to who knows,
right.
change hands, who knows what, thrown at rodeos, whatever. But now, just as the owner, you have more incentive to keep the horse,
right.
what you're saying. And I guess that's another aspect I never really looked at, but it makes a lot of sense. They get to stay in that program, become better, and
longer
even if you
transition period there,
yeah, if
it
you
gives the
own
trainers
them,
more incentive to keep them and not start another, you know, put another colt in the barn.
Right. No, I like that. I mean, it's really good, and kind of forgot what I was going
to
say there.
To me, that's the biggest deal because when you get these horses, and especially the ones that do well, and they give you your heart, you get so attached to them that it's hard to find the right spot for them. And if you do ever find what you think is the right spot, you want to feel like your horse is at its peak, that it's seasoned, it's seen everything it's going to see,
right.
and you're not taking an inexperienced horse and sending it to a rider that maybe doesn't have as much experience as the person that trained it.
Right.
And I think that's like a really big deal. So
where a lot of these have looked blown up after the futurities when they switch riders and they just go from a green standout futurity colt straight to a new person and a new scenario altogether.
Right.
Now there's a longer transition for
yeah.
them to get seasoned.
Well, they've been in a training program,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden they're not in that training program anymore, and everything's been uprooted. And obviously this podcast is about you guys and not me, but I will say, along with what you just said, like the scoop horse
mm-hmm.
that I had, I mean, we didn't sell him till he was 9 years old. Felicia Taylor owned him, and I mean, I took him to a few rodeos enough to know that he was going to handle the scene and do well, and to know that he was going to excel in a big outdoor environment. But I mean, I can't leave. I can't go rodeo, and I was never able to really do what he needed. But we did know that he would thrive in that environment and that he was special. But we just stayed very patient. So, I mean, I think his entire 8-year-old year, I maybe ran him 7 times. I mean, he's at my house all year and just didn't, I didn't want to run him at little jackpots, but it was just a matter of finding the right time, the right opportunity. And so many people had tried to buy him that for whatever reason, the reasons change every time, we'd always said no. And then when it came time to sell him, I was like, well, no one even knows that. No one thinks he can be bought. I had to make a Facebook post to sell a horse that qualified for the NFR this year after he was bought. But it was really just to try to attract that person. I know it kind of sounds wrong, but just what you said, to find the right situation for a horse when you sell him, when you know the timing's right, you know they're where they need to be in order for someone else to be able to succeed on them. And then you just hope that that person does right by the horse, takes care of them. And I mean, and I've been lucky that Sissy, I mean, she religiously calls me and comes back to me for like, hey, I need help, or this was my run, what do I need to do to adjust? I mean, she works really hard. So it was a great situation, but a lot of times we've been forced to have to bypass that. You know, you need to sell horses earlier because they go down in value, whatever. And now there is an opportunity to keep them and make sure you place them the right way and ultimately just do right by the horse. Cassie, tell us a little bit about your breeding program also, speaking of all things. We're going to take it. We're getting every subject because we know this is the first and possibly last time you're ever going to do this. So we're just going to talk about everything. Tell us about your upbringing. How's your brother doing? Like, we just want to hear all of it.
Well, I love the breeding aspect of it, and started out when, I guess, when I bred for Epic.
Right.
Later. And it just, I love thinking about it. I'm always curious what would happen if we breed this and this. And I like to try to complement styles as far as, like, if I look at a mare and see this is what she's lacking, I try to find something that would complement it. Maybe it's not the most popular thing, but just to try to produce a better athlete. And so I'm huge. I got to watch, I didn't run in the slot race last night, and it was just a thrill to watch. And you get to see the new up-and-coming studs, groups coming, and I am always thinking about that whenever I'm watching the juvenile. I love seeing what the studs are putting out there and kind of what direction the industry is going. And so I do kind of dabble in it. I don't have like a blue, like a standout mares or anything like that. And so I just try to breed the better my stock, whatever it is, and do a lot of research. I don't really do a lot of outside of the box. Like if I see a niche that works, I tend to do it and keep crossing that way. The first time I made the finals was on full siblings, and the third horse I ran that year was a 7/8 to those two that I ran. So right off, I knew what full siblings could do. I know they don't always work out, but I've had really good luck with doing them, and at least I know a lot of their little antics and a lot of the little things. A lot of them aren't as successful, but still go on and do, you know, really good, and at least I have an idea of how they'll train, and that they'll kind of suit me a little bit better. So I do kind of stick with the same. I have my own little wheelhouse that I stay in, and I know now kind of what suits me the best, so I do kind of stay there.
Right.
But I am always looking at the new studs up and coming.
I mean, I think you have to keep up, but I have a little bit more of, like, I'll wander outside the box every now and then. I get a little tempted. What if this one will turn?
It's easy to be tempted.
It may not, but what if it will?
Yeah.
It's not bred to. It's not even bred to slow down. But what if it will turn? Where I've asked you multiple times, who do I breed so-and-so to? And you're like, Danielle, I breed to 2 stallions.
Yes.
So you're asking
but
the
I'm
wrong person. So I'm asking, what have you seen? Not what are you doing? What have you seen? But talk about last night. Like, what, there were some horses in there by up and coming stallions. Like, did anything impress either of you guys last night, like, that you saw? I mean, obviously there were some impressive runs, but
I thought what impressed me the most was there were a lot of riders here that I didn't recognize before.
Absolutely.
That I didn't know.
Yes.
And were competitive.
Yes.
I thought that was, like, really great for the sport. That was the thing that really caught my eye the most. I think you have to have your own goal and your own approach, and you have to stick with it. Like, I don't deviate in what I have. it hasn't worked out for me. I think you're probably more of a risk taker. I don't ever cover color outside the lines.
Yeah.
I only have one or two horses, so I stick with what I
feel like works.
Even while what I know how to start with. And I know that if I can get it to do certain things, it should clock. I don't want to try and prove something or, you know, make a new path in the snow. I'd sooner follow in somebody else's footsteps. But that's what impressed me the most, that of the 60 riders that went in that field, I probably didn't know 20 of them. I had never seen them before.
Right.
So I think it was good for the sport, especially for anytime I see somebody that I don't know a lot about win, I think in the long term it's good for all of us.
Right. And that was just interesting all the way around. I mean, that horse, I kind of looked it up. It's Hollywood Gunnett on the bottom side and Cutting Bread on the bottom side as well. So completely, I mean, Ain't Seen Nothing Yet is proving himself to be a fabulous sire. I mean, he's made winners with all sorts of different mothers and all sorts of different trainers, training them and jockeys. So it's been really cool and impressive to watch what some of those have been able to do, and definitely one to watch for. But I'm like you guys, I was very impressed at just seeing, I mean, we're like, who's this, you know, people you never heard of, and that girl comes in, we're like, who's this? And that horse went in and smoked the first barrel, and I'm like, gosh dang, who is this? And then did it at the second, and she lets go and starts whipping to the third, and I'm like, this is someone that's confident in their three-year-old right here. Like, when you can whip a three-year-old to the third barrel and that, and
I think when I read the article, she'd never even been here before. So I think never had been to the BFA before.
Wow.
The way I read it.
That's the way to come.
And to make that run and to stay solid on all three barrels, I think it shows anybody here that, hey, if I get the right horse in the right situation, maybe I can do the same thing. And I think that's what this whole thing's about, is dreams. And
I did a little bit of Facebook stalking on her today, just out of curiosity. And she raised that colt, and I know there's been an article released already. I didn't read the article, but I just did a little Facebook stalking of her exhibitioning it throughout the fall, and it's out of a mare, and this is the first one she's been able to run out of that mare. So just kind of cool. I mean, it's a great story from what I could tell all the way around. I didn't realize it was her first BFA or anything, but imagine what a way to do it, to be able to come and do that. I mean, we've all been here, and I mean, you've won the slot race twice, so you know what it's like to come here and have to make something happen.
I'll never forget my first slot race, though.
Well, I'll never forget the one I made 2 years ago when I hit all three barrels either, but that's the point. Anything can happen. I mean, I hit all three barrels, and then the horse won the futurity here the next year, so I knew I was on the right kind of horse, but I mean, there are some obstacles in that arena that he'd never seen before, and that's what you don't know coming in. So when you see someone in her situation who's never been in this environment come through, and for her and that horse to have that much confidence is what makes it all the better, because you do realize what can happen in the slot race. The best horse doesn't always win.
I think the best horse doesn't win most of the time. It's who handles the situation best and
on
whose night it is.
Yeah, there was a lot of fabulous horses last night that made mistakes, and this happened, and it's hard to have your timing perfect, because most of us have never sent one quite that hard to the first as we're going to.
Tricky,
in the slot race.
Tricky environment. I mean, you've got that yellow wall at the third barrel where some horses get short. And I was impressed that there were a lot of people that I hadn't heard of that came in and made nice runs, not just the girl that won it, but a lot of people that could handle the pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And I was impressed that the stands were packed. It was hard to get a seat.
Yep.
I thought it was exciting. And I think that kind of stuff is good for the sport. I mean, that's really how I got sucked in. I started and had a couple decent horses. Was lucky enough to win Fort Smith, like my second or third year.
Which horse was that?
That Martha Smooth over horse won $105,000. It was the biggest check ever won. And I said, this is going to be easy. I'll just do this now and forget all the other hobbies. But the moral of the story was, it shows somebody that really didn't have a whole lot of experience that if you get the right horse, the right situation, the right night, it can happen. And it did. And it got me sucked in. And you hope runs like that get somebody like that just that much more incentivized and gives the people that were watching hope.
That's the thing, is everyone else. And I know, like, Aaron, my boyfriend, he's kind of from the cutting horse industry, where it's very different than what we see here. Like, you'll never see somebody like that win a major futurity in the cutting. And even and I'm terrible with names. And so, again, I apologize. But last year, a 9-year-old girl won second at the Pink Buckle futurity, in the futurity. I mean, you don't see that in any other industry, you know. Discipline is what you can at a barrel race, and I think that's one of the great things about our sport, is nobody cares how your horse is bred, nobody cares who you know, nobody cares about this. It's a speed event, and the timer doesn't lie. anybody can come do it. And that's what helps also to bring people in. You don't need a lot of money to do it. You said you can turn a $10,000-$15,000 horse into who knows what.
I paid $4,700 for that horse, and I let it go with the sale because it went for $3,700. And I had second thoughts, so I paid the extra $1,000 and bought the horse. But to kind of talk about your point,
yeah.
The thing that I like the most about barrel racing that you don't see in other sports and other environments, if I'm a boxer, I'm not hanging out with Mike Tyson or Sugar Ray Leonard. And if I'm a golfer, I'm not hanging out with Tiger Woods. But anybody here mm-hmm. can come up and can approach somebody like you or Cassie or Troy
even
or Jolene.
Even who you think
or
unapproachable. Anybody. Sorry, Cassie, yeah. They're going to be coming up to you now. She's damn it.
Anybody, because, we all understand the struggle. So that's, to me, is what's different about barrel racing than any other sport, is that somebody that's a novice can go and run against and compete and hang out and learn from people
right.
that are at the top level.
And sit there in the warm-up arena.
Yeah.
You know how much I've learned of what to do and what not to do?
That's where most of my training came from.
Absolutely. Watching people, watching the best trainers in the world out there warming up and working their horses and what they do and figuring out, watching them and figuring out why are they doing it. And usually you can. You
yeah.
can figure it out and try some of it yourself, see if it works, and maybe learn something, be like, nope, didn't work for me. Don't know how it works for them. But that's what's cool about
yeah,
it is
I agree.
There's so many different styles that are capable of winning, and which then leads to, more people in that. So I don't know. What other thoughts do we have here?
Going back to the breeding part, I was really happy to see that young stud come up. I feel like Ain't See Nothing Yet is mm-hmm. really making his mark, and he's a – he's in a lot of incentive. He's a really good, he's a good value, and there's a lot of other studs coming up, and I look for studs that are out of really good mares.
Right.
I think a stud has to have a really good mom, and there's some young ones coming up that are out of incredible mares.
I agree with you.
And I go a lot by what my colt starter thinks about them, and so, we're really excited about some of the younger studs coming up.
Right. It has been interesting having a living colt starter for me, mm-hmm. and especially him taking outside horses. He's one of those people who doesn't want to hang a shingle. He doesn't want a bunch of horses to ride, but obviously he wants to ride horses for people like you. I mean, it's exciting for him to get to see what those horses are going to do down the road. But it's been fun because it's given me a different, a front seat view of what these horses are at the mm-hmm. beginning and how they change mm-hmm. over, and what the process is to get them there. And it starts to give you a little bit of an idea of, in the past, maybe what went right or wrong and helping to create our horses as we go. But it's it's a whole different view on all of it. Mm-hmm. I lose my train of thought sometimes. I hope you edit that out. Every time I say, I hope you edit it out.
No. We're good with that.
She said stallions. Got it.
Oh,
see, because
yes.
I knew there was something. What Cassie said about the stallions, it being very important that they have a great mother. Sometimes you don't know. I'll be honest, Ain't Seen Nothing Yet. I was like, oh, here's another Dash to Fame Frenchman's Guy, Palomino Stallion, when he first came on the scene. I was like, just what the world needs is yet another one. But now he's proven he's not just another mm-hmm. one. He is the one.
He's special.
And whatever it is that made him that special, that made him a little bit different. I mean, he doesn't have a mother that won $400,000 or anything, but he's pretty cool. But I'm the same way. When I breed to a stallion, I look more, even compared to what they are or what their sire is, I look what their mother is or what she won. I want to breed to a stallion that has a very strong female line himself, and I think that's what helps make a great stallion. At least we hope so.
In a stud like him, I don't have the mare power, and so I like the fact that he crosses so well on different variety of
right.
mares. We don't all have a Dolly, a Repeat, or, in our backyard.
I hope Repeat will become Dolly
one
day.
I have to look for those studs that really are strong
right.
in the qualities that I want them to produce. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are producers, but not always with the things that you want them to produce.
Well, there's a lot of stallions out there that have great offspring that win every year, but I can watch them run, and I know that those horses don't run with my style of training. And I do fight my head like a lot of trainers, except not you, and that's what's cool about this podcast is I think that no matter how long you've been doing it, I do think it's still a struggle to figure out when it's hard to say no to a horse. It's hard to be closed-minded, or someone wants to send you a horse and that. I had one sent to me once, and I knew she was bred well. She was out of mare that won a lot, but I kind of knew, like, this isn't my type of horse. I've always known it's not. And, I mean, they kept asking and asking. I took it, and I placed at the first slot race on her well and never won another check on her all year. Like, I knew it was not my type of horse. And it really, I felt like, if anything, it might have been an injustice to the horse that it got sent to me. I mean, I tried as hard as I could, but at the end of the day, she really did not fit me. But it's, gosh, you're going to have to edit this. I get rambling, and then I lose my train of thought. I was like, where was I going with that? I don't know. I hit my head. I can't drink with this also. That's the problem. I've tried to drink, and I can't drink. But
it went good. We're halfway through the week. Everybody's been working.
I know. I'm like, that's why last night I was like, I can't. I can't even think straight right now. So right now I'm...
So let's just take a break.
Let's take a break right now. Are we on now? We're good. Okay, we're good. Okay, we're back here with Cassie Mowry, Michael Boone. We just took a little break, and some of the most brilliant things were said. Now I can't even remember what they were, but we were talking about the mental game, the mental aspect of being able to win at this level, setting goals and quotas. We're talking about setting a quota, no different than running a business at work and having goals and quotas that you have to meet, that the horses need the same thing. So talk to me about that, because you said something really cool about being able to leave the bad run behind when you have a quota.
Well, it's something we talked about as a joke, that, you know, we have sales quotas at work, and we have sales quotas in other businesses and thing we do. And, you know, I started setting the quota for Cassie at these futurities.
No pressure.
I thought the benefit was, as I think it's difficult in the sport to put a bad run behind you and to focus on your next run. And I think that's what I like the most about the futurities, is you have more than one chance.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it would be good to look at the bigger picture. So I set a quota when we come to a barrel race, and that's what we focus on. We don't focus on one specific run, and it works out pretty well. And I wasn't sure that she would be receptive to it at all. And so the first couple times it was kind of a joke, and she kind of fed into it.
She's like, still think it is a joke. I laugh every time.
She's humoring you.
Yes.
When I realized that made a difference was we were at the Stephenville futurity, the Lone Star, and
yes,
I set the quota, and she was $300 short, which was the first time that she was short. And she stayed up all night to see if she won enough money in the carryovers to get her extra $300. So I think it's...
Damn it, that $300.
I almost got there.
So, I think it's important to have, like, the bigger picture.
So, is it, it's a quota not for each individual horse for the weekend, but it's the weekend Cassie as a whole.
Yeah, for each individual horse defeats the purpose. The goal is to say, hey, if I have one bad run, I could still make it up somewhere else.
Right.
I mean, it has to be a realistic quota.
Yes.
You feel like you have a horse that's capable of this. You don't want to say it's five times more than what you think you can win. You have to look at what the event paid historically,
mm-hmm,
figure out what your horse is capable of, and set something realistic. And the goal is to say, hey, if I have a bad run, it's not that big a deal. I'll make it up somewhere else. You can't set it on one specific horse, or it defeats the whole purpose.
Right. That's a really interesting way to look at it. And it does change the perspective, because I feel like futurities, when I used to rodeo a lot more, you could have that bad run. It was hard to drive that far to make one run, but you were like, I got to do it again tomorrow. We have more futurities now that pay better than we've ever had before, but if we go back a few years, you would spend 4, 6, maybe 8 weeks gearing up for one futurity.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that was Fort Smith, and you had one run, one chance to qualify for the finals, and it was devastating if something went wrong in that one run, because you spent so much time focused on making that one run and preparing for that one run for who knows what to happen, where now even the futurities, it is easier to look towards the next run and hopefully fill your quota at that event, but at least we have more options to make up for it. If some of us don't always fill the quota, some of us are much more than $300 short.
Well, I mean, I think you got to have to set the quota what's realistic.
If
you're running multiple horses, you know, I think it's easier, and it might not work for everybody. When I first suggested it, you know, I thought maybe she wouldn't be on board with it because I'm ultra competitive.
Right.
If we do really well on a couple horses, I don't focus on the ones that do well. I focus on the ones that didn't do what
I've noticed that too, watching you guys. Is and that's what's cool and what makes those horses step up, where I do think that it's really easy to be like, oh, well, I won first and second, and you don't pay attention to the one that was 2/10 out because it made a bad run. You just focus on the good, where you guys will go home, turn the lights on, be in the freezing cold, and work on that one that was 2/10 off, and it's going to come around the fastest time of the weekend the next day.
I mean, all morning we spent time talking about what we wanted to do better on the three horses that didn't do what we wanted them to do. And I think, you know, you got to focus on every single horse. If they're on your trailer,
right,
they should be on there for a reason. And
that's why when she pulls up, they can all win first.
Well, I mean, that's not overnight. That's the other thing that I want to make people realize. It's not like anybody's an overnight success sensation here.
Right.
We both put a lot of time in improving and trying to get where we're at. It wasn't like you just snap your fingers and you can get there.
Yeah.
You know, you hear that all the time from country and Western singers. Hey, it took me 20 years to be an overnight sensation. And it's the same here. It's not overnight for
actors,
anybody.
Anything. Yeah.
I mean, you could get lucky on one horse, but to do something long term, there's a learning curve.
Right.
I think the difference is the people that really want to get better have to really want to get better.
Right.
You gotta watch and learn and ask questions and really freaking crave it. Like Cassie doesn't really talk very much, but she's always thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a difference between working hard and working smart.
Right.
And we're focused on trying to work smart.
What is it you think, and I want to hear this from both of you, but I'm going to ask you first, Michael. This might be a little bit personal, emotional type, but earlier this year, Cassie was literally on her deathbed at a futurity, in and out of the hospital, struggling to even get on her horse, let alone be able to win. And there was a little quote going around that you said to someone that of her laying down by her stall saying the only person that can beat Cassie Mowry is Cassie Mowry.
Right.
And because she was not functioning and still went in and ran the fastest time of the entire weekend, which thus led you felt guilty about it. Felt like you pushed her too hard to go in and do something that ultimately may or may not have made her more sick, which led to her missing Fort Smith the following week.
I did feel guilty about that. I mean, I felt like, you know, I pushed it a little too far that day. And, you know, we had help from a lot of people. I mean, she was super sick.
Right.
Had a lot of help from a lot of friends. I know that when we made the last run, it's the one I regretted. The CP he will be
epic
horse.
And that was the fastest time of the weekend.
The CP he will be epic horse, you know, wound up losing a shoe right before the event. And she was saying, hey, this is good. I won't run him. I took it upon myself to find Brian Wheeler and Jason Willis, who were nice enough to tie a shoe, a shoe on him.
Yeah.
And I sent him in there, to do what she needed. We'd worked hard
you'd
to get
been
that
working.
Horse ready for that.
Yeah,
horse.
You'd been working
and
on.
I wanted to see if it worked.
Yeah,
and,
ironing
you know,
things
did,
out.
But I felt like I pushed it a little too far then. And, you know, I felt like I pushed it too far some other times, too. She's had some injuries that she's battled through that, you know, maybe long-term weren't the smartest decisions, but when you have really good horses and really good owners, you want to do everything you can because that horse has a limited time frame as a futurity year. And yeah, I do in hindsight think I pushed it too far that time, but you know, she's a warrior. She is.
I don't agree completely.
I
feel like those horses, they were doing good and it was a big opportunity for them and they were ready and they wanted to go. And I just felt like I needed to do everything I could, and their consistency and their training and confidence carried me through that. I didn't have to do a whole lot for them, and I might not have got a third run out of them or more runs, you know, like they were ready. Everything was prepared, and I felt like, you know, that's what got us through that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But, well, I don't regret it. I mean,
I told him, because it made me feel sad when I realized that's how he felt, because at the time, like, I was like, this is awesome that he's supporting and pushing and driving her through this. I swear I wasn't glad that it was potentially making you sicker.
He gave me a little nudge.
Yeah, he gave you a little nudge.
He put me on my horse.
Said, you got this. Here,
literally.
I'll put the rubber bands on your feet. go. It's
weird that it happened at Waco both times. I remember when she went there with a bad back.
Yep.
It's weird. The chair was still in the warm-up hand.
Everything was the same.
That I would stand her on so she could get on a horse with a broken back. And I'm thinking to myself, man, you've got some problems, dude.
He warmed them up that time.
You need to reel this back a little bit.
Right.
And I really went to Fort Smith on my way home to see if I even wanted to do this anymore. It took that much out of me.
I know.
I felt that bad about it. People were surprised that I was there.
I saw you, and I was. It was a version of you that I'd never seen before.
Right. And that was really it. I went there to see if I wanted to do it, because most of the time I don't get to see the barrel race because we're working on our own horses. And it wasn't that far out of the way, but I said to myself, I got to figure out whether I want this anymore. And I went there and watched the barrel race, and I actually enjoyed it. And the thing that shocked me was to see how fast those horses actually go.
Yeah.
It's different when you're watching, like even in the slot race last night, when you're actually competing, it looks normal. When you're just watching, it looks like way faster. And I went home, and I thought about it for a while. I really thought that was, like, close to the end for me. And, it was just – it was difficult because, like I said, I felt like I crossed that line.
That's – kind of interesting. I mean, that happens midway through both of your greatest year you guys have ever had together. But one thing like that and what it does, I mean, I think it just is a testament to, again, the program and how much you guys respect and care for each other throughout all of this, that you want to see her win, but then you saw it affect her health. And
yeah, I've started thinking to myself, is it really that important? Is this really worth pushing her that hard and pushing myself that hard? There's more things than just going to a barrel race and trying to win for that horse or that event or whatever. So it was a different moment.
I thought it was. I'm a huge fan of Will, so I loved watching him make that run that he made. And, I mean, I love Cassie, but I did not miss the fact she was not at Fort Smith. I was okay with that, and I think everyone else was too. So we're like, if anyone wants to win Fort Smith, this is your only chance. Like, this is the year you can do it.
It was odd kind of rolling in there because people, like, seemed like super surprised to see me. Like she was going to be in the trailer behind me or something like that.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like
the olden days.
It was like
Mike showing up at the futurity.
It was like an out of body experience. Like I don't even remember a lot of that well. I just knew that for my own sake, I needed to go and try and either get it behind me or be done with it.
Right.
Is what it boiled down to.
What about Cassie? The mental game. Obviously, it's easy to be confident, or much easier to be confident when everything's been going well. It's easier to have that right mindset when you have confidence in your horse and the training's gone well and you keep the right horses in your program so you don't have to ride something you're not comfortable on. But still, it's very select few winners in this world, period. It doesn't matter what event, what sport we're doing. I mean, some people just rise. Just like horses. We all have had horses that rise. You're talking about Emmett. Like, those high-pressure situations, he just rises to the top. I mean, you're Emmett. Like, you just rise to the top when you need to. Like, what? There's no secrets. And you know it takes confidence, but what is it mentally?
I think I've competed, whether it was when I started out riding jumping horses, now barrel horses. I've been in competition a long time, and so I think it takes a lot of experience just doing it. And the other thing I've learned, I'm not afraid to fail, like, at all. I don't care if it doesn't go as planned. I just know I learn from it and do something different, back to the drawing board. I remember winning a slot race here, and literally the next day I got 2 no times in the juvenile, like, went from the very top to the very bottom, and I feel like it didn't make or break me. I didn't make a big deal about it. It didn't upset me. I literally just, I knew, I realized why they did it and had something we needed to work on. They're afraid of the banners. We went home and hung up whatever banners we could find in my arena at home and got ready
for the same thing that year.
Yeah, like got ready for the next futurity. And so I just feel like it's always learning. I always, if I completely mess up, and sometimes after the worst mess up, I figure out the most. And so that's why I'm not afraid to bomb.
Yeah.
I don't care who's watching. I'm not nervous about what people are thinking. I don't think about any of that. I don't care. I'm literally there just to try to get the best I can out of my horse or try to make it better than it came. It's all just a learning experience, and it never ends. Like, I'm rodeoing like on Emmett, and he's had a couple years experience, and we're still evolving and trying to make him better. It just never goes away. So I think that's the biggest thing is I'm not afraid to fail. I don't get upset or emotional over it because I feel like that feeds to the horses. And if you don't make a big deal out of it, to me, it's not a big deal to them. I literally act like, oh, it didn't happen.
Right.
And I made some adjustments. We talked about it and figured out what we needed to do and execute a new plan. And your year doesn't have to start out amazing for it to be an amazing year either. Mm-hmm. Like this time last year, two of the horses that I've had really good success on this year didn't do well at the juvenile, like, at all. But we knew they were talented, and they showed little glimpses of greatness.
Right.
And so I just always keep that in the back of my mind. Like, this horse, he's got the moves. He's just not putting them in the right places. He needs more, either more and go more or more adjustments, mm-hmm. you know, to get that out of him. When you realize their talent, that's what keeps me confident and keeps me wanting to work on one, is when you feel those little moments. And
right.
It just keeps me hooked, trying to figure it out, how to make it better and solid.
I think the fear of failure thing is key. And I think that's mm-hmm. what gets in the way of a lot of people, is whether it's disappointing themselves, feeling like they let the horse down, or their owners down, either way. So have you ever felt like you let Michael down on one of his horses?
He takes all of it really well, so he wouldn't.
He's never got mad at you.
No, never, no.
He
never.
Says you're always spot on, but
no.
Nobody's always spot on.
No.
But
I don't think I've ever gotten mad at her. Sometimes I'm disappointed in my horse, but I'm always figured I'm the one that trained a horse, so I'm really the one to blame. I don't think it's much as much confidence as it is knowing you did all the prep work coming somewhere,
mm-hmm.
and whether it's what I do in my real business or what she does here. Knowing you did all the preparation, it makes you more confident, because you know even if it didn't work, you're not going to look back and say, well, I should have done this or I should have done that.
Right.
She's like she's a bigger risk taker than what I am or what most people would think. She doesn't think anything of changing a bit.
I was going to say,
I don't ever have really regrets.
With the best.
Yeah. I'll do something. I was called deliberate. That's
well,
my
deliberate.
One word.
Deliberate, the one
to
word.
To describe me.
Yep.
And it is, like, I'll think about something I want to do. I put a lot of thought into any adjustment that I make. And if it doesn't work, then I learned, you know, I need to go a different route, maybe the complete opposite route.
Right.
But I learned to make that adjustment, and so I just don't ever really look back. And I don't have – he's more statistical and keeps up with all – I'm just trying to get the best out of each horse I can every time I run it. And if I have one that's just – so upset, so nervous, I know it didn't warm up good, I'm going to lower my expectations and throw a lot of stuff out the window and just try to get through it and not for it to be a bad experience or a huge setback for later. I'm always looking down the road.
Right.
I'm not one. I mean, I guess some of my better runs, I will get outrun. I'll leave a little on the table. I feel like I don't just ask everything out of my horses every time. I really want to leave that day knowing my horse is happy and I wasn't cutting every corner to get it, and it's just going to continue to stay consistent or, you know, doing everything the right way. So I try to keep that in mind, always the next run.
Right.
I always try to keep that in mind. So I'll just do whatever that day, that run, that I feel like I can get by with and it still be a good experience.
I think that's important, too, is, the incentives being longer and just more opportunities throughout these horses' careers. It does probably help a person let some things slide.
Mm-hmm.
You've always had that mastered. But, like, for other people out there, like, just understanding there's more opportunities to do well. But your horse always has to leave the arena with the most positive experience mm-hmm. that they possibly could have had.
It's a building process, and
right.
it never ends.
This is true.
When they're solid. Like, when they're supposedly solid horses.
There's no such thing as
we're
a finished
still
horse.
We're working on them.
Yes.
I am still doing slow work on my older finished
your
horses.
Your NFR horse.
You would just assume people don't. It never ends. You constantly, they get sore or they have a bad scenario. You're always having to evolve and stay,
right.
keep them at the top of their game. They don't just stay there on their own.
I think that's really hard for a lot of people to understand, especially with the money in the industry when people go and buy that quote, finished horse, they don't understand what got it there and what keeps it there, and that it's still an athlete. And, I mean, I've never played any other sports, but I know enough to know that the best athletes in the world have coaches that train them daily and watch them daily to see any little thing that goes awry, whether you're a golfer or a quarterback. I mean, people are watching to make sure everything's going right, keeping you in the best physical condition. I'm like, why are more people not doing this for your horse? Because so many of the problems when you sell a horse, or even that we have, that you let that little thing slide that first time you felt it, and you're like, oh, but he still tried. I'm not going to pick on him over this. And then that little thing, and then pretty soon your whole riding style has changed to try to make up for what happened over time. It doesn't happen in one run. And
effect.
I think, right. So it's catching those things early on. And but I think we're all a little bit guilty of that as a trainer, of trying to figure out, okay, what do we nip in the bud right now or let go? But when you sell a horse, or you see these people out there buying horses and they let the whole program go and then can't figure out why their 1D horse is no longer a 1D horse, I think that's an important thing for people to understand, is they're an athlete and they're an equine athlete. They're not human. Like, they can't think their way through this. Like, it's, so you start letting those little habits form, and pretty soon you've got a really bad habit. I don't know why we treat them different than, I mean, Tom Brady, Tiger Woods, anybody. I, you know, pitchers have coaches, batters have coach. Everyone has a coach to coach them through things daily. But
barrel horses don't. Yeah, we all have runs where it's a good run, or, you know, and we, but we leave there like, oh, I kind of didn't like how this felt.
Right.
So you go back, and your warm up for the next run is digging a little deeper in your slow work on whatever that little hitch is that you're trying to kind of, you know, not pick a fight with them, because it's not, you know, outright just a bad deal, but you're still, you know, keeping that in mind that it could get worse.
Right.
So.
And that's, again, I don't know a ton about sports, but I'd have to assume the difference between hitting a home run or a foul ball, whatever, is like just a quarter of an inch of placement. So what's the difference between a barrel horse running barrels? I mean,
when
you fill those little things and have to make that little tiny bit of adjustment, I think people need to understand you need to do that. And consistency is key. And that's what leads to confidence when you go to compete, is the consistency leading up to it. There's no right or wrong with barrel racing. Everybody has their own way, but it's the consistency, I think, that's going to build the confidence overall. What do you see, changing the subject rapidly yet again, what do you see in store for next year, like futurity-wise? I know you have a few less futurity horses than you're used to having going into next year, so.
I have three, the same that I have this year, but two of them, well, the one's not in as many of the incentives, so I plan to go to the futurities, and I feel like they're pretty close to on schedule. It's been hard with as these new races now, all these incentive races tend to go longer than our futurities used to, I feel like.
Right.
So it does take a lot of time away when we're gone for a week at a time. They like to keep us here.
Yeah.
And then I was gone for the rodeos. Had Emmett just kind of got me in that situation. And so I was gone a lot more this year than I ever had been. But I do look forward to going with these three fillies that I have. And going to the winter rodeos like I normally do, that's always my goal, is to get into Houston every year. And those rodeos are close. And now I have a couple moving into derby horses that I can start seasoning at the rodeo. So I never really make a plan. I just kind of winging it. Whatever's ready can go.
Okay. I respect that for sure. Respect that. For those of you that don't know Cassie well, she's probably one of the most humble champions and graceful winners and losers. I mean, I've seen her win and fail, and you see the same person in either circumstance, and I think that that's what truly makes a great winner. And there's a lot of reasons, that one of them, that I know I consider her all around is the greatest that's ever been. I remember Cassie came to me when she was maybe like 19 years old for a lesson. Okay, we both lived in southern Utah. I will never forget this. I knew of her because she had, like, randomly won the high school nationals on a random horse. And we had the same farrier, and I'd never met her. And then she went off to Texas for college. And my horseshoer was like, dude, she's legit. She's the real deal. I'm like, whatever, Chad. You know what I mean? Well, lo and behold, she kind of reaches out. I think we bonded over Metallica at one point in Reno one year. Yeah. And then she reaches out, and she wants to come take a lesson. Okay, this will be the joke of the decade, that Cassie came to take a lesson at one point. She comes, and, like, I will never forget, after that day, I was like, I'm the one that needs to take a lesson from her. Like, she was that good from the get-go. Like, she's truly gifted from the very beginning. But always open-minded and always wanted to learn. And that's what makes her who she is today. So she's very humble. And she's not ever probably going to believe that she's the greatest. But I don't know that there's anybody that doesn't believe that. And again, I don't just look at her stats. I mean, I look at her as a person and everything. But what I want to know, how do you feel about being called the greatest there is?
I feel really uncomfortable, and I'm sweating
humble.
Right now.
Humble.
I know. It's just, it is, a lot of people put in a lot of work, and there's so many great people in this industry. I don't feel, like, any different. We all work so hard at this, and I just feel like I've been able to learn from the best people. Like, when I came into the Futurities, I latched onto you, and I would watch Troy in the warm-up pen, and, like, I did my research, and I came from a background of writing three-day eventers. We had instructors.
Right.
I had lessons every week. It was huge in our industry. You didn't do anything without somebody helping
their
you.
Their eyes on you.
And so I felt so lost coming into this, being kind of self-taught, fumbling through it. So that, for me, it just made sense to find someone that had a lot of success and ride their coattails and follow them around. And so that's where...
Watching Troy 20, 25 years ago was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
he was
unbelievable what he could do. And watching him tune one and watching him jockey one, like, there was a lot to be learned from him.
To me, Troy's the greatest.
I did tell some people last night that... and. You may agree or disagree with this. I know you put Troy on a higher pedestal than most people. I mean, he deserves to be up there, and I'm with it. But I was like, Troy in his day was as good as they'll ever be on the back of a barrel horse. He could pull things off and do things that are just unbelievable. But he's always been the greatest in my eye, and it's like now there's the female version of Troy, and I think it's incredible. But
Troy and I are friends. We've worked together a lot. We've had a lot of success together. I have a lot of respect for him. The timing and his athletic ability and his ability to just focus under pressure and ride different horses is unreal. It's not something you teach. It's something you're born with.
Well, he was able to win in a far different spectrum than Cassie. I know we're getting off the base here, but still sticking to greatness in general. Troy would win on horses that got hauled into the Futurity that he hadn't even been on.
Yeah, for sure.
And just go figure it out. And it's not that Cassie can't jump ride something, because we know, yes, Cassie can jump ride something because she has timing and feel. But the things that we got to witness Troy do on the back of a horse on something that someone else had been training, riding, tuning, everything, and he gets on and zips it around the warm-up pen and goes in, and it was incredible.
The things I've seen him do with a horse I've never seen anybody else do, and I probably never will see anybody else do, is timing and just feel for a horse and just pure athletic ability.
Yeah.
Or it's something that's, like, generational.
He was way ahead of his time at that time.
And horses there were different. They were race horses that you trained to turn.
And he made things happen that never should have happened.
Right.
I can't count how many times I saw him pull something out of who knows where, and I'm like, nobody else could have done that.
And some of them were my horses, so I knew that they were kind of
like,
limited.
I'm a fan.
He's just that good. And if the horses were the same way, bred the same way now, he'd have the same level of success, because that's something that he can just do. It doesn't the times and the advanced age, and he still has everything that he had back then. He's just that good.
Yeah.
And that humble. You never meet
the nicest,
a better person.
That's the other cool. There's so many humble champions in our industry. It's crazy.
Horses will keep you humble.
Well, horses will keep you humble.
And you never know when somebody's going to have an influence on you. Susan Clapp came up and introduced herself to me at the last event here, and she said, hey, I'm a fan of you and a fan of your horses. And I said, well, I'll tell you something that you don't know. I said, part of the reason I got into barrel racing, when I got into it, I studied it for a while, and I liked your style the best, and you were riding Martha Six Moons.
Yeah, Creon's.
So that's why I bought the Creon's Request. Yep. I said, I remember what it ran at Fort Smith. I remember what it, that it fell at Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. I thought your style suited me the best. So I bought a Martha Six Moon and went from there. So that's one person that has never even met me that influenced my career.
Right.
And I think that's the opportunity you guys have with other people, because there's always there's always somebody watching.
Something like that. Mm-hmm. Mine are more like Pritzy Dash, and then they don't work for anyone. I've influenced people too, but it hasn't been quite with that much success afterwards.
You, there's a lot you just don't know. You don't realize how many people are watching.
Right.
You know, people that are competing at the highest level that you wouldn't know. Like, Susan had no idea that.
Yeah,
and I mean, that's who I patterned myself after, because that's who I thought I rode the most like.
Her horses did have a beautiful way of working, too.
And that's the
way
that's the way I ride. So, I mean, it kind of goes back to the details and trying to figure out a style and a program that works. Just kind of being random and not having a plan in any sport or any business will get you nowhere. You just you got to know where you're going to know if you're getting there.
Right. So,
and I lucked out. My first colt I picked just randomly was a Dash to Fame.
A Dash to
Fame.
Off
the track, $3,500. Yep. And I thought, this Futurity thing's easy. It was easy to train. I was like, I can do that. And then it just got harder. Really hard.
His name was Disrespect.
He was amazing.
He had like a 23 speed index on the
track. Barely made the pattern on the track. I loved him.
Yeah. I don't think Cassie hadn't Futurity'd much, and she had a college rodeo. So she had to send him to the speed horse with me. So I got to jump ride. That's how good a trainer she was. I've been able to jump ride behind her a couple times very successfully. So that's how good of a trainer she is. But I can't remember what he won. I did well on him. And
really
I won like over 8,000 or something, which, and I'll never forget the phone call to you, and you're like, you won how much? Like, it was like, and that is when Cassie Mowry, the Futurity competitor, was born.
Hey, I could barely afford to feed myself there. I was like, this is good.
Like, you won how much? So like, I'll keep him longer if you want.
And really, I got a huge opportunity when I went to work for Jed. I got to learn a lot about bloodlines, riding a lot of full siblings, half siblings, all out of the same. I rode all cash not credits. And so I did learn a lot about bloodlines there. And Jed was awesome. He never put pressure, unrealistic expectations. I fumbled my way through it, and he let me.
Right.
You know, like it was, he just, it didn't go great. It was always a learning experience. And so I've just been surrounded by people that have always been so encouraging. And that's why, I mean, I guess I don't have a fear of failure. I take it all as an experience.
Right.
And Mike, you know, we talk about everything and getting the horses prepared for everything. And so I feel like when it doesn't go as planned, the whole thing's a team effort, and I have a great team. And so I just feel like it all goes back to that. I have a lot of confidence in all aspects that get me there.
And you do the things to keep that confidence high. Mm-hmm. Again, I think that's important for other people to understand and realize, too, is we all struggle. You getting
two
day after the slot race on colts that ultimately, I mean, were winners, but they had a bad day, and not letting that get you down. But I think a lot of people don't understand how much the people they put on that pedestal go through the same battles and everything daily that they do, but it's just part of it. They seem to think that you never fail, they'll never fail. I know that 2 years ago, the slot race, when I hit all three barrels, and then that was hard to take. I feel like I let a lot of people down.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of weeks later at Oklahoma City, you hit all three barrels on Famous Ladies Man in the Derby. And that same year, Lisa Lockhart hit all three barrels at the NFR in one run. And I'll never forget telling someone that you also hit all three barrels. And they're like, well, no one's going to remember that Cassie did that, but they're going to remember you did in the slot race. And I said, I will. I'll remember that Cassie did that. I will always remember that I saw her do something human.
I forgot about it. I forget about all the things. Literally, I was trying to find a bad video that I did just a month ago, and I was looking for 30 minutes trying to find this run, and I was like, you know what? I did delete that off my phone, probably for a good reason. I just was trying to look back on where I'm at on one of my horses, and that video was gone.
Yeah.
And I don't really look back. I always am just trying to look forward, and I think that's the way to.
I agree with you on that, and I've told people that forever, and I've been that way since I was a kid. And I think different people have different ways of learning. And like, I'm a very visual person. Like, you can sit there and explain something to me all day long, and I will not understand it. But if I watch you do it, like, I'll understand it immediately. Like you, I was a lot, I had good mentors growing up, but there was a lot of self-teaching going on. And one of the only ways I could learn was to watch other people. Mm-hmm. My parents weren't horse people either. So I just had to watch people and try to figure out, why are you doing what you're doing? But again, I'm going to forget how I was going there. If I watch a bad run of myself or anybody, that's what sticks with me. So I might watch a run one time to try to figure out, you know, a little something that went wrong, and then I'm done. Like, I won't watch the bad run, but I'll watch the good run 30 times and just let that image of what happened, how I rode, what the horse did, where I took it. And even to go further, there's been many times, and I've told other people, when I give lessons and someone needs to ride further up into the barrel two-handed, I'm like, go home and watch Cassie Mowry videos. Like, just brain it. Like, put it in your brain. Just make sure it's instilled there. And I'll do the same thing. If I know I have to ride a horse a certain way, I'll think of who rides the way I need to ride, and I'll go watch something that they did, or make it a point to walk to the fence and watch them run, just so I can see it, because that's how I learn. So if I watch that negativity, that's what's going to be in my brain. And I think a lot of people have been trained to watch those bad runs, to study what they did wrong. And I think the opposite. I think it's just a form of negativity that sticks with you if that's what you do. Like, understand what you did wrong and try to move forward.
Oh, I'll watch that bad video. It's the first one I want to see, but then it gets deleted. Yeah. I literally want to see, did it look how it felt?
Was it as bad as it felt?
Yes. And then it's gone. Moving on. Yeah.
I find it usually looks better than it feels, which actually makes me more angry, because I'm like, nobody understands why I'm disappointed right now.
For sure.
But no, I think definitely people need to focus on the good moving forward in that. So it's part of building confidence and getting better. But unless there's something else, you guys, you feel good? You want to say anything? I just want to congratulate both of you on a great career and an unbelievable year. And good luck.
Yeah.
Good luck
trying
moving forward.
Trying to keep
forward.
It, the momentum going.
Absolutely. I wouldn't slow down now, but thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having
us. It was really fun.
Thank you.